Hey folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Michael Shelley here. Today's guest is Howard Grimes, drummer. He's known for two things mainly. He's a Memphis guy, and he played on some of the early Stax stuff where he's really doing some super interesting rhythmic work there. He played at Stax until the mid, 64 or so, and then he moved over to be the house drummer at Royal Studios for High Records, where he played on just some incredible, incredible records and really, really developed a style and a sound there that I think is hugely influential. Even though he's not sort of a household name, I think that drumming style and that sound are really ubiquitous and really well-respected by musicians. So his new book, Timekeeper, My Life in Rhythm, me and Howard Grimes. And I do want to point out that if you go to wfmu.org/Michael, there are archives of my chats with Steve Cropper from a few weeks ago, and Duck Dunn, and William Bell, and Eddie Floyd. So if you're into the sort of Stax story, it's there for you to listen to anytime, wfmu.org/Michael. That's it. He was a really laid-back guy, really sweet. And I do want to point out that we went so long that I only got to, maybe 80% of my questions. So if you sort of notice a hole in the interview at 80%, it's because we got interrupted and they said, you've got to wrap this up. We're sorry, but he has another interview. So I'd love to have him back. Also, I want to point out the book is full of kind of a little more of a raunchy, not raunchy, but he sort of drops F-bombs and kind of dishes the dirt a little more than his laid-back persona in this interview might indicate. So you might want to pick up the book. Once again, it's Howard Grimes' Timekeeper, My Life in Rhythm. As we listen here, by the way, to a Willie Mitchell tune, 30-60-90, that Howard is one of the co-writers of. All right, enjoy this, my chat with Howard Grimes. Howard Grimes, good morning and welcome to the program. I loved the book. It covers all the standard music business biography stuff, the recording sessions and your influences, but you really get deep in about your life and your ups and downs, and you paint a vivid picture of Memphis, and I want to get into all of that stuff. First question, you were born 1941, so when you were coming up, the kind of soul music that you're so well known for taking part in, that kind of music did not exist yet. So what was your generation listening to when you were a kid that influenced what ended up becoming the Memphis sound?
Well, I was only about 6 years old. I was hearing the music that was played on the radio. My grandfather, which was a Baptist member of the church, he was listening at the Grand Ole Opry. Listening at Hank Williams, listening at Minnie Pearl. So listening at that music, that was the first song I heard off of Hank Williams was "My Bucket Got a Hole in It."
That's funny because that music doesn't even have drums on it.
Right. I hadn't heard drums yet. What was happening? I was trying to figure out where the beat was. And as time developed, there was a gentleman named Slim Rose, used to be a TV show here in Memphis. And his brother was Dusty Rose. And I used to watch him on Channel 13, and I never saw any drums, and I was trying to figure out where the beat was, and I saw the, there was another gentleman, I don't know his name, but he played acoustic. That's where the rhythm was. I heard the beat. As the Western movies that used to come on, Gene Autry was singing, and I was always trying to find, and I found out the rhythm was coming from the acoustic guitar. Hmm. Everything was there. So actually, that's where I picked up the beat from the acoustic guitar. They had stand-up bass and violins and guitar, but the acoustic guitar was the main source of the rhythm. It was hip the way it was handled and played, because I hadn't heard the beat yet. The beat that I heard came from gospel music, and that was clapping your hands and your foot, you know, in church.
Mm.
That's where I picked the soul of the beat up. But as time developed, you know, I was in 1941, so around 45, 46, I started hearing a new sound, which was, I heard a song by Bill Doggett called Honky Tonk. That's where I heard the beat, the drums. So it was very interesting, you know, to hear. Because back in that time, man, you know, everything was actually done by foot and hand. Gospel groups were singing. They was either patting on the side of their leg. They had an old hollow flow in the church, you know, and I could hear that one beat, the stomp, which they called late on, as I learned as I got older, was the downbeat.
So what was the first kind of live music that you saw outside of the church?
The first live music I saw was Hank Bell and the Midnighters, Fire Royals.
Did it leave a big impression on you?
Yes, it led a deep impression on me, because to hear that music, I later started playing his club, which was called Curvy's Tropicana in my neighborhood, and it was out on Thomas Street. My cousin and they used to go over there, and I didn't want to go to clubs because in my neighborhood, New Chicago, there was a few cafes, man, you know, and I saw things happen there, and I didn't like cafes. I didn't like fighting, and I didn't like things that... The music of what I heard, I was too young, but I stand on the street corner and I would hear what was come out the cafes. But my cousin and her friends, one night they went to Curvy's and asked my mother, said, "We want to take Howard over." I didn't want to go over there because my mother and them used to always call Curvy's Johnny Curvy's. And we had cafes out there. It was cafes. I didn't know there was live bands until she took me. So I went and I saw Ben Branch in the Largos. And they sit me on. I was too young to be in, but back during that time, they used to have what you call a vice squad. And most of the law enforcement, I knew them as a kid. And they looked after me, so they allowed me to come in, but I couldn't hang, you know, because of the alcohol. I was too young. So they sent me to the side of where the drummer was, and that's where I saw what was going on.
Hmm. It sounds like you were a natural on the drums from as soon as you started. Am I right, or how much of it is hard work on your part?
Well, during that time, they used to have movies on Channel 3. It's called the early movies. I used to see these shows with the first drummer I saw, and it was Gene Cooper. And I didn't know anybody could play that fast, or hands was that fast. And I was very deeply touched the way I saw this man playing, and that was my dream. I wanted to become like that and play, and I wasn't sure I could do it. So I came on a lot of band leaders that took me on, put me on their shoulder, like Floyd Newman. He had a group that I played in West Memphis, along with Isaac Hayes was in that band. So these clubs I was playing in, Gene Bowlegs Miller, they were always telling me about drummers. So the first blues drummer I heard was Cozy Cole Topsy. So that influenced me a lot behind Gene Cooper. I saw the story of Gene Cooper, but I saw Sal Mineo play.
right, yeah.
I'm talking way back, man.
I remember. I've seen that movie, sure. So you started playing live gigs really, really, really young. And I read in the book that you backed up folks like, you know, Bo Diddley and Jackie Wilson and Fats Domino and young Marvin Gaye. This is all when you're a teenager. It's pretty amazing to go from, you know, watching these guys on TV or in a movie theater and then being backing up some of the same folks you were probably listening to on the radio or on a jukebox or something like that. Did that blow your mind a little bit, or were you just cool?
No, that was a radio station. It was called WDIA, which was Mr. A.C. Williams, Nat D. Williams, Martha Jean, Honey Boy. And they put a show together called the Starlight Review. And they would have various bands. It wasn't but two bands that I got a chance to play with, both of them, each one of them. Not at the same time, but they had put a show together with the Motown singers, which was Temptation, Marvin Gaye, Theo LaKilda, Mob Johnson. Mob Johnson was the first artist I played behind. I didn't know these people. I was very young. I didn't know these people because I was hearing the music on WDIA. WDIA was a great radio station, which it still is, but it don't have the character that it was that when these great DJs was there. And they would put a show on every year. They called it Starlight Review. Then it came the Goodreel Review. And the way they did it, they would use Gene Bolex Miller's band 1 year, and the next year they used Ben Branch and the Longos. So I had opportunity, versatility, to play with each one of those groups at a different time. So they would book artists, and they made, it was deals. It was like who had the hit record that was hot at the company. They would call in the corporation and talk to the president of the company, and the way they set it up, they would pay for all the expenses, and they would have them to come. They pay fare, everything, you know, and what would happen. They didn't pay them. They played their record. That's the way it started. That's how their records got popular.
So when you're backing up folks like that at such a young age, did you rehearse? Did folks, you know, like, I assume if you're backing up Fats yes. Domino, he wants the beat a certain way. Is that right?
I pretty much had my way of nobody. I just played, you know, the music came from my mother. That's where it come from. And the teachers that I came under, I didn't know nobody was listening to me. I never had that idea because I love music. So I was really endorsed to a lot of music, jazz, Ray Charles, Cannonball, Adderley. I was a youngster. All of this is what was going on in Memphis at the time. And I was into all of it. So the artists that I got opportunity to work with, They never give me any problem, you know. They would satisfy with whatever I did. And I was very comfortable because I was listening to music all the time. You know, I listened to New Orleans music. So, I played calypso music. I played mambo, clubs, rhythms. So all these different type of patterns and rhythms they were stored in me as a kid growing up. So once I actually got a chance to be professional, which started with Rufus Thomas, Satellite Records in 1958, Rufus came to my mother's home, and I didn't know how I was hired to go with him to go over there to record. I never record a record. Know nothing about record. But I was playing with Bob Talley's quintet, and Bob Talley recommended me. So when I got over there, I met Chips Moman, which was a great man. And Chips took me under his wing, man. And I had been listening to that New Orleans music, Jesse Hill, Ooh Poopa Doo, all that stuff. I'm a rhythm nut, you can say, you know, rhythms, because it came from my mother. My mother always heard guitar, bass, piano, and drums. And she could pop her finger so loud, man. You know, I guess she was putting the beat in my ear, man, because it fit right with the beat on the record of the drummers. Hmm. And I always listened at what she was playing and what she was doing. So when I got to Satellite with Rufus, we had a little, he's trying to come up with something, and it didn't fit what Rufus had. So Wilbur Steinberg, which was the stand-up bass player, he told Bob Talley, he said, "Talley, tell Howard play the rhythm that he plays in the club." So I was playing with them at Hi-Hat Club. So Alpha Rudd was singing all these songs like Ooh Poopa Doo, you know, all this kind of stuff. So I played the rhythm off of it, and Chips heard the rhythm, and Chips Moman, he said, "Yeah," he said, "that's it, man." So we played the rhythm, and I never told him about it, but I took the rhythm off of Jesse Hill, Ooh Poopa Doo.
Yeah, I definitely hear in a lot of those early Satellite sessions that you're on that you are really experimenting with all kinds of different rhythms and making a lot of great grooves on those records. I want to talk about that, but let me just go back one second to the club scene in Memphis. It sounds like Memphis had a particularly lively club scene during those times. Was the clubs segregated? Was it black and white clubs, or was it a mixed audience?
Bill Street was for pretty much anybody that came. It was actually black people. Only three Caucasians that came on Bill Street. That was Dewey Phillips. That was a wrestler named Sputnik Monroe that I used to see on TV. And Elvis Presley. Elvis Presley used to come to the Flamingo Room, where that time I was playing with Gene Bowlegs Miller, which was Andrew Love, Cleve Shears, bass players, Clarence Nelson, and there was a keyboard player named Richard Shine. And Clifford Miller was very fond of Elvis. And we used to have what you call the ladies' night, which was Wednesday night. And Elvis would come up, and Elvis was singing songs that the Coasters was doing. If you notice in that movie called Girls, 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 all that stuff was of the Coasters. Poison Ivy and all that. Elvis was singing Coasters and Brooke Benton's music. So we was playing it behind him up there. People loved him, man, you know.
That's thrilling. So when you were playing on a Beale Street, you know, with Bowlegs Miller's band on a night like that, how many hours or how many sets of music was one night?
Well, there was another club down the street. It was very popular and famous. It's where Bobby Blue Bland, all the blues singers, they knew Sunbeam Mitchell. So Sunbeam Mitchell would play the late, late hours, because we played from 10 to 4. And Sunbeam had four drummers. So the first two sets, the first two drummers played from 10 to 2. And the second part was from 2 to 4 in the morning.
Because he would just wear out the drummers otherwise?
Well, I don't know. You know, it was just the way the system was set up down there. Sunbeam Mitchell had a lot of great friends, you know, police officers and politicians and people. And the way the system, of course, I don't know much about politics, but I do know we had great politicians and great laws at that time. And the community, the way the people had things at work in the system, they worked between Clifford Miller, Curry's Tropicana, Mr. Curry, and Sunbeam Mitchell. That's where those clubs were so popular and famous.
So you mentioned that you played with Rufus, and you played with Rufus and Carla, and, you know, these are the real early satellite releases. William Bell's You Don't Miss Your Water, these are tracks that people still listen to them today. And one thing that I was listening to quite a bit this week as I was preparing to speak with you was the Triumph's tune Burnt Biscuits from 1961. That's one that really has quite a rhythm on it. And it's you mentioned Chips Moman earlier. That's a Chips Moman before he sort of had a disagreement with Jim Stewart and left Satellite Stax. He was kind of the main producer over there. So tell me how that rhythm came to be on that record.
Well, when I was playing out to Curry's with Ben Branch, the Five Royals had a song out called Slumpity Slump. I can do the slumpity slump. I don't think I ain't. That rhythm came from there. And all of these patterns I was playing, like I said earlier, they come from Hank Bell of the Midnighters and the Five Royals. And I was playing all that because that's what Ben Branch, that's what time it was. People were happy, joyful, peace. You know, it was all about the music, man. You know, it wasn't nothing about color, race, this and that. You know, they was hearing the beat. I watched the women dress tails when I play. I could see the dress tails shaking. I watched the men's feet when they was dancing, how they moved off the beat. It was the beat, the rhythm. And when I got over to Satellite, well, they didn't have really many artists. The first three artists was Rufus, William Bell, and Carla. They had Prince Conley, and they had Barbara Stevenson. Those was the artists. And the Mad Lads came a little later, which I cut their first record. Hit record Shop Around. But what happened is the artist that was over there, the Marquees, we were the band that was, they had Vote Records. They had made two other labels to make it look like we had a group of artists, and we didn't. It was tryouts, most of the artists that came in, they tried out, and they accept them like the Mad Lads and them. But Chips Moman come up with this idea, man. You know, he played harmonica, so he come up with this idea, the harmonica. And Booker T started messing around playing this lick, bump to bump to bump to bump. Well, that kicked back in my head when I was playing over there with Ben Branch. So I knew there was the Five Royals, but I never let nobody know what I was doing, because I was playing all of this stuff way before this stuff got popular. You know, we were just playing it in clubs. You know, the records were selling, people were buying them. And it was a great time, man. And the Triumphs came out from that song, you know, that Chips Moman played harmonica on. And that's how it, you know, that's how it went down, man, you know. Things started developing later on, you know, a year or so later, you know.
You mentioned that you didn't have experience in recording studio. Was there any adjustment you had to make because you were so used to playing in live situations for hours at a time? Was there any difference when you got to a studio? Did you have to change it up at all?
Well, when Rufus came to my mother's house to see what she allowed me to go, I'd never been in a studio. I didn't even know what a studio was. And when I went over there with him, it was a theater. It was called Capitol. And when I went inside, I had never been inside a studio. Didn't even know. I saw the drum kit. And then I saw an organ. I saw a piano. But I had never sat down. I saw mics around the drums. But I had been playing in different nightclubs. Sometimes they may would mic the drums. They would put a mic down up on the snare drum on the floor. Didn't have many mics to mic everything. So I was kind of slightly comfortable with the way they were set. Long as you could hear the bass drum and the snare, the cymbals and all of the, they would take heat to themselves. But to go in that studio and I saw what I saw, and I had no idea what I was getting into or what was getting ready to happen.
Huh.
But Chip's moment was such a humble man, you know. He took me on his wings, man, you know. I didn't know he was listening at me. There was another drummer there that his name was Terry Madden, I think it was his name. He was drumming with the Marquees. Chips was using Steve Cropper, Doug Dunn, Smoochie. The integration of the blacks was Booker T, Floyd Newman, and Gilbert Cable, and myself, Wayne Jackson. That was the horn section. And the first time, I didn't know, but the drummer, the original drummer, because it was Marquees was all white. It was a Caucasian group. And Terry couldn't hold the time. That's what it was. He started off okay. But, you know, cutting the track, the drums would slowly go down. They kept cutting. So he had to stop the track because he couldn't hold the time. He couldn't stay up. So when Chips heard me playing, and he just made a switch. And I had a chance to cut two of the Marquees' first albums. And, you know, all that rhythm that you hear, if you heard the Marquees, that walking the dog and all that stuff, that stuff came from me, because the first two albums that I recorded was Popeye Stroll, which was the Marquees, and all them beats on there, Wimpy Burger and all that. That stuff came from, they used to call the heebie-jeebie beat. That's what Bowlegs would say, give me a heebie-jeebie beat. So when you listen to that Walking the Dog, that Rufus come out with later, it wasn't nothing new. All that stuff that came, what they did, they upgraded and they raised the tempo. But we was playing it back the way Chips had me playing it. We was playing it back like church. You hear the church when you hear the choir clapping, pop, 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 they be singing. It was the same thing, but that was the only beat I knew, because at that time, that's what all the musicians was saying, play that heebie-jeebie beat. I didn't know what heebie-jeebie, I guess that's somebody come up with that name, but that's what it was until today. But
yeah, I never heard that before.
Yeah, that's what it's heebie-jeebie beat. It's, I got it from Bowlegs, you know, that's what he used to say, play that heebie-jeebie beats.
In the book, somebody talks about that the Floyd Newman song, Frog Stomp, which I think Floyd Newman's not even on. I don't hear a saxophone on that song. But they sort of say that that song is your identity, like your stamp is so clear on that one.
Floyd Newman come up with that. I was playing Isaac Hayes and myself, and the other two musicians are Joe Williams, and I don't know Basie's real name, but all I knew was Basie. Well, this particular night we was playing, I didn't know Floyd was listening at what I was doing. I didn't think I was doing anything. I've always tried to find my place. That's really why I listen to so much music. I've listened to so many different drummers, because every drummer had his own style, and I hadn't developed mine yet. So I was looking for it. This particular night, Isaac Hayes and I come up with this particular song, and Floyd heard the beat, and when we finished it, Floyd said, can you remember what you played? I said, well, what did I just play? He said, a beat. He said, that's you. He said, tomorrow we're going to go to Stax and we're going to cut that. So that's how it started, you know, and Floyd gave me my identity, you know, I didn't know it. So it was the hi-hat, the foot, and the snare. And I've been playing that away ever since, you know. He told me that's how I got my identity, through that song, Frog Stomp.
That's very interesting. Man, I love that tune. You know, if someone would ask me what is Howard Grimes' drum style, I would say that it's kind of very groovy, but it's very straight down the middle. You kind of throw in some rhythmic twists thrown in, not a lot of crash cymbal. It's always, like you said, you're always looking to find your place in the song, and I think that's right. Like, you can always hear that you've taken the time to find just the right spot in the song to fill it in. I mean, how do you describe what you do, what your style is, what you're known for?
Well, you know, there were so many drummers that was really playing, man, and I didn't want to try to steal nothing. They had their own identity, because if you couldn't shuffle, you didn't have a job. Memphis was all about the shuffle. That's where the groove were. And the backbeat and the foot, which is the stomp, that's where they come up later. Well, the stomp was what actually set everything in motion for Memphis music. It's the stomp. And if you didn't have the stomp in the backbeat, wasn't nothing happening. So I started playing what Floyd had heard me do at the club, and I just continued to play. And the more that I played, there were people accepting it. There was band leaders were saying, "Hey, this that groove, this the Memphis sound. This is it." So, you know, as I grew and as I aged, and I search other music, I never heard nothing the way that the pattern I had played. So they had told me all my life, stay in your place, play it straight, don't run all over the place, don't be busy, just sit in the slot, lock it in, and hold the time in the groove. And I got so good learning that, because I was very comfortable myself. You know, drummers was showcasing, man. You know, they was want to impress the women. And, you know, cats was flipping the sticks and stuff. They didn't tell me. Floyd Newman used to always tell me. He said, "Hey, man, you don't have to do all that." He said, "Look, just play your drums, man. Get in and get out. Start on time, end on time." So I learned. You know, I learned all of this from Floyd, Bowlegs, but when I got to Willie Mitchell, that's where it really locked in, because I had been playing them up-tempo feels, you know. It was like a little faster. And when I come to Willie Mitchell to try to make his band, I had come off the road with Paul V and the Raiders on that tour. I tried Willie's band, and I took off the running. We had a rehearsal, and I took off the running. Willie stopped me. He said, "Oh." He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm trying to make your band." He said, "Well, look at him." He said, "We're going to all start together." He said, "And here where we're going to play." He said, "We're going to all get there at the same time." And when he set the time, it was like I stepped inside of his spirit, because the man was so laid back. I wanted that. I wanted everything that was in him, peace. And later on, you know, as when he hired me, he started teaching me feels, timing. And I locked into it so well, because he was setting time at first, but when he taught me, then he turned it over to me. He said, "Well, how would you set time?" So I've set time on everybody I've recorded. Denise DeSales, Detroit Emeralds, Ann Peoples, Seal Johnson, Otis Clay. You know, I could go on and on with people, concerts.
Yeah, it does sound like you and Willie were a perfect match, like just on the exact same same wavelength, and just real complimentary to each other. You mentioned playing fast songs and stuff. I was listening to a track you played on from 1965, Sam and Dave, "Goodnight Baby." Is it hard to play? I would think it might be harder to play slow songs, because it's just hard to keep that tempo when it's so slow. Or am I wrong? Or is this easy for you?
No, you're right. But it's amazing that you called that song up, man. Steve Cropper was the cause of that song. I had already cut Tina Hodges that wrote I Take What I Want. So we had already laid that track. But Steve, he put that song is in a 3-4-6-8 time, man. And it's in time and out of time. But the way that Steve was playing the line on the guitar, I was confused for a little while because I couldn't catch the connection where Steve was. So Steve was bowing down to me. And I finally caught on, but yeah, it was difficult, man. That song is in 6-8-3-4 time. And where the beat was supposed to be normally, like I've been playing at it, you hear the average drummer play. You always hear a straight 4-4 in the backbeat. Bop, 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 bop. But this thing was bond, and where I was supposed to be, and I thought the way I was playing, it was somewhere else. But it took a minute with Steve working with me, and it tripped me out, man.
That's funny. You know, Al Jackson Jr., another Memphis drummer and a guy who played it high, played it stacks. You go to great pains in your book to point out that you guys were always friends and always friendly. And I was listening to another Sam and Dave track you play on, A Place Nobody Can Find. And as I was listening to that, I thought, you know, I'm so glad that Howard plays on this track, because if Al had done it, it would have sounded totally different. I think that's like a great example of the difference between you two and how you have your strengths, you know. That's just such an... to me, that the way you play on that is just you all the way.
Well, you know, that song, I didn't know of Al Jackson at the time, because Al Jackson started out with Gene Bowlegs Miller while I was out in North Memphis at Curry's. And then later he went to Willie Mitchell. I had never met Al, but I heard him call him, you know, Little Al Jr. And Isa Hayes and David Porter hired me to come in to do that song. And the shuffle with the foot and the backbeat, it all connected to what Duck Don was playing, the bass line. Well, Bill Tyes was playing that stuff in clubs. And I would learn when I go out to clubs. I go to clubs to see what drummers are doing, what the bands are playing. What can I hear? Or can I get an idea that I take back to the studio? That was back in the 60s and the 70s when things was much better. And Steve Cropper come up with this feel on A Place Nobody Can Find. And only thing I could hear off there to what Duck Don was playing was the shuffle with the foot, the bass drum. So I tried to see would it connect with what Duck was playing. And it felt good and it worked. And Chips gave me a thumbs up, you know, he shook his head. So that mean, you know, it was acceptable. And I took charge of it, man. You know, that shuffle it's a difficult beat to play, you know, because you're shuffling your foot and it's got to constantly be there. You know, you can't just cheat on it a little and then get off. Because to make it work with what the bass player is doing, and Duck had locked in and I could feel what he was, and it just made it all great with the foot. And I don't know what you call that song, but that song did give me the blues, but I got it.
It's a very, very unique groove that's kind of cooked up there, yeah.
Steve Cropper always had ideas, you know. I was feeding off of what he would come up with, because his stuff was always out of sync. So you had to be thinking, man, you know, because he was just, you know, tricky guy, man, fun.
So you mentioned that you end up at high, and the rhythm section mostly was these three brothers, the Hodges brothers. And I can imagine it. I mean, it must have been a little bit hard to penetrate a family unit. And I know that I think one of those brothers lived with Willie Mitchell. So it really was like a tight situation there. Was it hard to get in there?
No. I had, like, you know, I'd been playing so long on North Memphis side. And I was hearing so much music. And pretty much any musician that I've worked with, it always came over with me, but I was looking for something really to connect. And I knew from hearing them shuffles on Bill Doggett and that stuff, that's where my head was. When I came to Willie and I did hear the Hodges brothers, I knew right then and there, them three brothers was just fantastic. I knew Leroy, Charles, and Teeny. What happened, I found out through Leroy. Leroy was listening at Motown. He was listening at James Jamerson. That's how it came together. Teeny was listening at Ike Turner. And Charles Hodges was listening at Jimmy Smith.
Oh, yeah.
So those sounds, the way those sounds were, and I knew there was something going on with them three brothers that I could hear. And the moment I locked in and started, it fit. And we got into each other. We stayed out each other's way. Them guys were so simple, man, you know. I didn't know who and where until later on they told me who they listened at. So that's how it came together.
Tell me about The Room at Royal, because those records all have a very distinct sound. You know, you mentioned all those Al Green and Peebles and Otis Klein, O.V. Wright, and all those people, all those Willie Mitchell records. Is it the way The Room was constructed? Did you spend a lot of time tuning the drums? Was it where the microphones were, or was it just the way you guys were playing, or some combination?
Well, Willie Mitchell was very particular about drums, the sound. And when I first come in, the sound was already unique with Bill Black's combo. I was listening at the early stuff before I came. And Bill Black, Ace Cannon, it was great music came out of there. You know, I could tell it was solid, it was soulful. So when I came over there, the studio was pretty much padded well. It was tight, everything. It was muffled, it was great sound. We had 8-track machine. That's all little hits come off of 8-track. Willie was cutting on 8-track. So Mr. Cantrell, which was one of the co-workers that worked at High Records, he was such a great engineer. He was the one that made the board. And they heard me one day playing, and I didn't know. I asked Willie later. I used to ask him, why do you go inside the board when I get ready to record? I never seen him do that with Al Jackson. And I was kind of curious about why Mr. Cantrell and him were going. And he told me one day, he said, well, Howard, he said, I open all the pots up on you. He said, I cut you hot. He said, I don't want to miss nothing you playing, he said, because you're playing things that are very interesting while you're holding that time. And you getting in and out, you're sealing holes, he said, which I've heard no drummer do that. He said, so when you play, I don't want to miss nothing you're doing.
That's quite a compliment. So tell me, when you were working with Willie Mitchell, would you guys work up one song at a time, or would you work for a whole day, or were you working on just by the session, or how did it work? And tell me, when someone would bring in a song like Tired of Being Alone or Love and Happiness, one of those songs, how long to work the whole song up? How long from when you first heard it till you were cutting it?
Well, actually, when we was all connected together, we was business. That's the way Willie trained us. We were business. Willie was business itself. But the way it all laid out was Teeny would sit down and play the chords. They write the charts out. And nobody else would play. And once he wrote, played the chords and the charts out, we all heard what was happening. But nobody knew what Leroy was going to play. Nobody knew what Charles was going to play. Then Leroy would pick up the bass and he would move in off of what he heard. And I mean, it didn't take no more than about the most, at least it took about 10, 15 minutes.
Wow.
And we had songs just that, I mean, we was all into what we were doing. And it was so beautiful the way that it was. We never sweat, so we'd cut like 4 or 5 tracks a day.
Oh, wow. I would not have guessed that. And were you cutting with the singers live in the studio, or would they add on vocals later?
I never did play with the band. Most drummers play with band. It's better for the drummer to listen at what they're doing, because there's different arrangement on the way that who's doing the song and whatever it is. It could be breaks. It could be something there that you need to know. So you need to hear everything they're doing. And I always would listen. I never played with them. And I always figured everything out on listening at them. Then when I seen they was comfortable with it and they had it, then I would go to the kit. Willie hadn't heard what I was going to do yet, but he always knew. It didn't take me but 5 or 10 minutes, because I'm listening all the time, so I was always listening at him. Sometime I would take my hand and go over to the organ where Charles Hodges was, and I would just keep time. I just beat on the top of the plate of the organ, and that would give it more push to what they were doing, and they'd pick it up, man, like 10, 15 minutes. We had it, so Willie said, that's it, let's cut it. That's the way we did them.
And would you guys sit and listen to a playback of the, you know, once you guys were done recording a take, or would you not listen?
Yes, Willie would play it back, because he'd be so excited. Things that Willie was hearing up in them tracks when we cut them, you could see the joy all the time in him. So I was always comfortable. He was comfortable with us, so we would never burn out. We was always full energy, you know. We was intact, and we were ready, man, you know. And we knock out 3, 4 tracks a day. Then he let us go.
Well, the body of work is so incredible. I can imagine it was very inspiring. Let me reintroduce you. Howard Grimes is our guest, and his new book is called Timekeeper, My Life in Rhythm. And folks can go to howardgrimesdrummer.com for information and order a copy of the book. And like I said, I really, really enjoy the book. I tore through it. I couldn't put it down. It's super, super interesting on a lot of levels. How did the pay go at Royal? Did you get paid per song, per session, per hour, per day? And did it change once songs like Tired of Being Alone would go to number one on the charts?
Well, we was, by us being the studio staff musicians there, we got paid through Papa Tune Records. We would pick up a check over at Papa Tune's in the week, get paid by the week.
By the week.
Yes, when we did sessions, I never got to be a lead. He was passing the lead around, you know, Teeny. I think Leroy was lead session on a couple of sessions. I never was, but that was pretty much the way it was back in the 60s, you know. We was go to Papa Tune and get checks on the weekend.
Do you remember how much those checks were, or what's the ballpark?
I don't know what that check was, but I wasn't getting but $106 a week.
$106 a week. Wow. That you just blew my mind. You mentioned earlier that you had played with Paul Revere and the Raiders, and I know that you were the first African-American artist ever to play at this Coliseum in Montgomery, Alabama, when George Wallace was the governor and was really not into that kind of thing back yes. there. Yeah, that's, I mean, just tell us that story if you can, just kind of quickly, because that's very interesting.
Well, Flash and the Border Records was playing at this club, which was Fred Alfonso's, called the Thunderbird Club. It's a very popular club. George Klein used to come there. And, I mean, everybody, man. And Flash and them was a great group. And they used to always go on this tour every year. Dick Clark would come to Memphis, to what Flash would explain to me. And he would put the two bands together and go out. Well, the drummer they had with Flash and the Board of Directors, he couldn't hold time, you know. He was somewhat similar to Terry. And he was out there playing with Steve Alamo, Tommy Rose, Keith Allison. And what happened is Chips Moman spoke up for me. He said, "You all need to get Howard Grimes." Well, I had never been on tours, and I didn't know, seen them, you know, the Beatles and Rolling Stones. So I took the gig. And when I went out there, at the time that Dr. Martin Luther King was, all of this situation was going on. But I didn't look at it under them circumstances. I went out to try to help my mother. You know, my dad had left us. And I didn't think anything would be bad, or, you know, it would hurt, but I ran into some difficult problems out there. And George Wallace, they didn't want to let me play in the place. He said, this inn ain't going to play in there. You know, he said, James Brown ain't never played in here, so he ain't going to play. So it started a slight little confusion. And Paul got very seriously angry. He told him, said, "Take Howard back to the bus." So he took me back to the bus. I was sitting on the bus, and I saw him out there standing around and gathering a circle. And I got to thinking, because I had an offer to come to Willie Mitchell Band before all this incident went down. So Paul, seriously, man, he stood up for me, you know. He raised hell. He said, "So-and-so, so-and-so, we don't have to play here." He said, "Every time we come here, this is what happens." So evidently, this had happened before with the drummer before I took his place. His name was Steve Hope, that played with Flash and Board Directors. So I was thinking in my mind, well, I'm here at the wrong time. But some kind of way, you know, they worked it out. And they didn't know whether I was going to play. I didn't really want to go out after I went through that, because I never had that experience. And I just didn't know, you know. I said, maybe I need to go home. I'm at the wrong time. But what happened, the governor, state senator there, he told him, "Let me play." You know, he said, "Let that kid play." So it happened. They sent a whole police force down to the auditorium. And Jerry, which was the manager of the Flash and the Board of Directors, he stood with me. So he stood up for me as well as the governor there. And they thought he was coming to do something to us, but he sent the police force down to make sure nothing would happen to me. And from my understanding, a close friend of mine that had passed away, his name was Gene Mason. For about 10 years, I just never said nothing about it because I was really messed up. And I wanted it to go away. I didn't want to think. And this was my first lesson of what racial discrimination or whatever you want to call it. I wasn't raised that way. I wasn't raised on color and people and all of this. But so he told me the other part of it 10 years later before he died. And he said, Howard, he said, the night they didn't know whether you was going to perform. And we had him to come out, the gentleman that called me the N-word. He begged my partner, told me he was sorry, forgive him. So I said, okay, you know, it's all right. I was thinking about coming to Willie Mitchell. That's the reason why I didn't. I had another gig waiting for me. But he told me, he said, well, he can play, but we don't want you to put no lights on it. He said, we don't want no lights on it because we don't know how the people inside, the kids, going to respond to it. He's black, so. Jerry told me, said that, they told him, said, I want you to put every light on Howard. The first note he hit on the drums, put every light on him. And that's what happened, man. I was playing behind Stevie Lamo, opened up with. And when the lights hit me, man, it was so blind, I couldn't see nothing. And then they levered us down. And those kids in there, man, they went crazy, man. They didn't look at no color of me, anything. And it shocked me, but there was so much love given to me, man. And, you know, I give the thanks and appreciation to the governor of the state. He was the one told him, say, let him play.
It's an interesting story. And the book does have, you know, I know you're not a political person. That's not what this book is about. But it does have a lot to say about race and just about your views on things. And like I said earlier, your views about how Memphis was at the time and sort of how it changed through the years. You know, Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated just blocks away from where you were working. It must have had a huge impact on you and the music you were making. Do you think that's accurate?
I think so. The night we was, that incident happened with Dr. King, Willie Mitchell got a call. We was in the studio. They had put a curfew on the city. But Willie had told us that we could continue to work like we had been every day. And when we came out, you know, we wouldn't be arrested or anything. And when we got through cutting Al Green, I came out and got in my car to come home. You know, man, I hear so much and see so much stuff until it's just a shame to see it like what I see now. It was semi the same thing, but it's a different situation. It's in politics, COVID-19 and all this stuff. But I tell you, when I walked out of this studio tonight, that curfew, it was like I had came from heaven because I was playing music and I could hear everything. There was no disturbing, and it was just a peace of mind to see the jeeps and police officers and things riding and maintain the street. And it was, for me, it was a piece of time. And it was a great experience to see the city be at peace like this for this confusion of things people don't understand, man, you know. And I drove all the way home playing Johnny Taylor, Tyrone. And that music just sounds so good because there was no interference in the street. Huh. No car horn, bus and stuff. So, you know, I've always remembered that, man, because musicians have musical ears, man, and they're supposed to. We're supposed to hear. And sometimes we play a lot of bad music because condition of our ears. So much confusing, man.
That's a very interesting way of, I mean, I'm sure you'll never forget that night ever. At one point in the book, you tell the story about a musician from Motown who comes down and he kind of can't believe all the drama that goes on. You know, he kind of says that at Motown, it's like a factory, and down here, there's all this trouble. And within the book, you tell lots of stories about all these characters in Memphis. Some of them are friends and family. Some of them are just musical acquaintances. But people get killed. They go to jail. People get stabbed. You get stabbed by your wife. There was a lot of drama going on in your life, and it seemed like you are just a, you know, pretty soft-spoken guy. You were never out looking for trouble, but you kind of got your share of trouble. And when High Records got sold, your life really took a roller coaster ride. Like I said, you got stabbed. Somebody put a curse on you. You ended up sleeping in your car. How did you get out of that bad spell for you?
It was God. I didn't actually know what was happening. You know, I never did nobody wrong. I never did nothing to anybody. I've been taught, I was trained, and I did my best on my work and plan, and people seem to have been pleased with me. And, you know, I wasn't taught to think that I was better than anybody else because they taught me at a young age. But there's so many, you never know who's against you when you are not doing any harm to anyone. There's a lot of jealous people to the way the business is run. And with me, I never did indulge with things of other people. I always stayed my distance, and I picked the places I wanted to go because the way I was taught. And I don't know. I played well. I respected people. My wife that I married, she did a lot of things that I didn't understand or know. And she was popping pills and stuff. And it created a lot of problems with me. And I don't know why she always picked a fight with me, and I tried to avoid it. And she was going with a cop. I was playing the Plantation Inn with Floyd. And this cop, I'll come back. I left my stick bag, and I had to go back. And the car was sitting in the driveway, and we got into it. But there wasn't no fight or anything. I went on to work. But I went to court. I went through a lot of things I didn't understand. And they took my home from me. And I slept in my car on the street. I was homeless. And, you know, I was ashamed to go to my mother's house. And my mother was working for Light, Water, and Gas Company at the time. So I would drive over there and sit in front of her house 6 o'clock in the morning, sleep in the back, because I was up and down the street all night. I didn't know why all this was happening to me. I never did nothing to nobody. I wasn't paid anything. So I got sick, and I had an out-of-body experience. I went into a life and death thing, and I didn't know what that was. And my spirit body got up, and I was standing in this cave in a tunnel, and I saw a light. I heard the voice say, "Walk to the light." I started walking. The light was so bright I couldn't see. And as I got to the edge of the cave, it leveled out. It got where I could see. And it was God standing there, clothed in white linen, as it says in the book of Revelation. I had been reading it a long time. And his arms was set out to greet me, and I walked up in his arms. And I heard the voice say, "You have obeyed me well. I'm going to send you back." And I said, "I don't want to go back. I wanted to go through this door I seen." And he told me, "So you can't go through there yet." He said, "I'm going to send you back." And he told me, "I don't want you down there running your mouth," he said, "because they're going to call you crazy." So I knew it was God. Hmm. And he said, "Speak when I command you to." So he told me, he said, "Howard," he said, "I want you to find an artist. Draw what you have seen here, what you went through." He said, "I want you to write your testimony, what you heard." So I have it today. I've showed it a few times. I found the artist on Beale Street that was coming in to a blues city where a friend of mine, Earl LaPearl Blues Band, was playing. And he drew what I said. And when he drew the three churches, I told him I didn't say anything about churches because I didn't hear God say nothing to me about church. So I said, "What the three churches?" He said, "Well, Howard, I know you've been there." He said, "And I know you saw God." He said, "I've seen him too." He said, "The three churches stand for the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit." So I knew then. So everything has been great with me since that. You know, I share every chance I get with the Holy Spirit, speak to my heart to share, you know. I shared it to a pastor, and he read the testimony and the picture that was drawn, and he told me, he said, "Howard, you been there." He said, "I know you been there." He said, "You were sent back. The world got to hear. They got to see this." So a great friend of mine, Otis Clay and Darryl Carter, we came up here. I brought Darryl Carter to Scott Beaumont's studio, and we wrote a song called "Sin." And it said, "If you're living in sin, you're not going to win. You got to ask God for forgiveness if you want to make it in."
What a fascinating story. I would love to see that drawing the guy drew of what you saw. You're going to be 80 years old in just a couple of weeks. Is there any stopping you? Are you going to keep on playing drums forever?
As long as God allowed me to play, I'll be 80 in August, 22nd of August.
Yeah. Well, I do appreciate you taking some time for us, and we've been listening to some amazing records that you've played on all morning this morning. It's a great story. The book is called Timekeeper, and folks can get information over at howardgrimesdrummer.com. Do you have a favorite thing that you've played on, a favorite tune?
One of my favorite songs I cut on Eddie Floyd was called "On a Saturday Night." Mm. That rhythm that I played on that, Steve Cropper created that rhythm. It come through his creativity. And Eddie Floyd told me some years later, he said, "Howard, you could have hit record on for me." He said, "And I never sung my record because there was a drummer couldn't play that beat." So I've always been excited about it. And I had a chance with the Bo Keys when we went to New Orleans. I had no idea that Eddie Floyd was on the show, and nobody didn't tell me. So when he came out the dressing room, he saw me. He said, "Say, man, nobody told me you with this show." Yeah, I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I can sing my hit record tonight." He said, "No drummer never played this record, so I had a chance to play the record in New Orleans with him on a Saturday night.
The beat that nobody else could play. Yeah, that's amazing. Well, thank you so much, and best of luck with the book. I really appreciate you taking time for us this morning.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, I'm looking for my baby. And when I find my baby, I'm gonna kick back the rust. I'm gonna pull down the shades. Well, I know everything is gonna work out fine. Just me and my baby and a glass of wine on a Saturday night. Oh yeah, on a Saturday night. Listen, if we gonna have a good time, then it might as well be a good time. We're gonna kick back the rug. We're gonna pull down the shade. 'Cause I got a itching to be with you. 'Cause your kind of love on a Saturday night. Oh yeah, on a Saturday night. All right, work it out, son. Well, I know everything gonna work out fine. Just me and my baby and that good old wine on a Saturday night. You know what I'm talking about, fella. Listen, on a Saturday night. Oh, yeah. All right, now, get it. Oh, yeah, darling. On a Saturday night. Everything uptight, baby.